22nd of November, 2011, a Lamrim meditation class. We're going through the graded stages of the path, how we develop our spiritual motivation in order to reach the enlightened state of a Buddha. And for this, we go through three stages. The initial scope of motivation is to work to improve future lives. Intermediate is to overcome all uncontrollably recurring rebirth completely, and the advanced stage is to work for the enlightened state of a Buddha. We have covered the first two stages, the initial and the intermediate. We're on the advanced scope now. Just a brief review. We started with the initial scope in terms of thinking of the precious human rebirth. How wonderful, how incredible it is that we have a precious human rebirth, because it's only in that precious human rebirth that we can build up enough positive force to be able to actually make any significant progress, because our negative force and the habits of our negative force from destructive behavior and disturbing emotions are so strong, and the positive force that we've built up in the past might have been sufficient for getting the precious human rebirth, but the more that we're angry during the precious human rebirth, the more that we weaken that positive force, and that positive force is constantly ripening in this rebirth, and so that also is getting less. But it's only within the precious human rebirth that we have the possibility of having enough discriminating awareness to be able to choose, you know, between acting destructively or not acting destructively and so on, so that we could build up more positive force. But that positive force is always being weakened by the negative force that we have. So it's only in the precious human rebirth that actually we can overcome this syndrome, which is very, very difficult to overcome. So this precious human rebirth, in which we have the opportunities to meet the teachings are available. There are teachers, there are people that are supporting it. We're a human being, we are not a dog at this time. And we are receptive, we're open to this, which the vast majority of human beings are not. So this is quite extraordinary in that circumstance, and if we don't take advantage of it, we are incredibly foolish, incredibly short-sighted. So we look at the rarity of the precious human rebirth, the value of it, how difficult it is to attain, and then we realize that it's not going to last forever because of death and impermanence. Death will come for sure. We never know when. And the only thing that's going to be of any help is if we have at least taken the preventive measures to avoid a worse rebirth in the future, return to the so-called lower realms, in which then it's going to be really, really difficult to ever get out of there again, since we only build up more negative potential, more negative karmic force in those states, and very little that we can do to improve our situation if we are a fly or a cockroach or something like that. So a goldfish in a bowl, what can we do? Not very much. So death can come at any time. We have to take some preventive measures to be able to avoid a downfall. And then we think what it would be like to have a rebirth in these lower realms, these worst states of rebirth, the so-called hell realms, these joyless realms in which our minds and bodies are totally filled with unhappiness and pain. So-called joyless realms is the connotation of the Sanskrit term, or clutching ghosts that we're always clutching after food or drink or, you know, warmth or cold or something like that. We're never able to get it. We're constantly frustrated, constantly chased by other ghosts and so on. So we're completely paranoid and how awful that would be. Or to be an animal, insect or fish in the ocean, which we could be eaten alive at any time that some larger animal or larger insect comes and bites off our leg or bites us in half or something like that. How absolutely horrible that would be. Then we think, is there a way to avoid this? And yes, there is a way to avoid this. So we dread a lower rebirth. We're afraid of a lower rebirth, but we're not paralyzed, feeling that it's helpless and hopeless. But we see that there is a way to avoid it, and that's to put a safe and positive direction in our life, what is indicated by the Buddha Dharma and Sangha, so-called refuge. And we've seen that the deepest source of this direction, in order to avoid worse rebirths and so on, is to achieve a true stopping. So that state of a true stopping of the causes for this, and the true paths of mind or understanding that will bring that about and result from it. This is the Dharma refuge, the Dharma source of safe direction. The Buddhas are those who have attained it in full, the Sangha, Arya Sangha are those who have attained it in part. So that's the direction that we want to put into our lives, to strive for the Dharma, as the Buddha Dharma, as the Buddha and Sangha. Buddhas have done, and the Sangha is in the process of doing. First thing that we need to do in order to go in that direction is to make sure that we stop getting further horrible rebirths, worse rebirths, and that means to avoid destructive behavior, and that which is the cause of unhappiness and lower rebirths. So that meant and led to the full discussion of karma. We went into that in great detail. Karma, we saw, was the compulsiveness, this compulsive aspect, that compulsively we act destructively, compulsively we think and speak in a destructive sort of way, and that is quite awful. So, we have to overcome that. First way to overcome it is just simply willpower and self-control. Don't do it when we feel like yelling at somebody, or hitting somebody, or lying, or whatever. Well, that was the initial scope. The intermediate scope, we saw that, this compulsiveness of karma is there even in terms of being constructive. And that as well causes problems when we are this perfectionist, I have to be good, I have to be perfect, and so on. This big strong ego grasping that is behind compulsive do-gooding, good-doing. Good-doing is the word. That this as well causes problems. And then we looked at the problems and suffering of the higher realms of rebirth, of the so-called gods, these divine beings, and the jealous anti-gods or quasi-gods are always fighting against them, and the sufferings of human rebirth, and then the sufferings of any type of rebirth altogether. We saw that whether we are unhappy or we have our ordinary happiness that is never going to satisfy, never lasts, we never have enough, and we never know what's coming next. And the more of this ordinary happiness that we have, it usually turns into suffering and unhappiness, dissatisfaction, like eating too much of our favorite food at one time turns into a very unpleasant situation. So, want to get out of that. So what is behind all of this compulsiveness, whether it's acting in a negative way or a positive way, what's behind karma, the disturbing emotions, anger, greed, attachment, lust, jealousy, arrogance, and so on, naivety, all of that is behind the compulsiveness with which karma affects us. So, we looked at the disturbing emotions. And these disturbing emotions, the primary ones, the secondary ones, how they arise, their causes, etc. We looked at all of that. And what we see is that really the disturbing emotions and compulsiveness are the main factors that are keeping us in uncontrollably recurring rebirth. And it's this uncontrollably recurring rebirth that we want to get rid of, because that's the basis for experiencing unhappiness and our ordinary happiness, the ups and downs of life. So in order to avoid and get rid of that, we have to avoid the basis for that, which is this uncontrollably recurring rebirth with all the physical and mental mechanisms that will perpetuate unhappiness and our ordinary happiness, our mood shifts going up and down, up and down. So karma is compulsiveness. I mean, karma is compulsiveness and disturbing emotions. And behind all of that is our naivety and unawareness of reality. So we looked in general at how death, bardo, and rebirth occur. That is the process of uncontrollably recurring rebirth. And then we looked in more detail about how it actually works with the 12 links of dependent arising, seeing that all of it works from the basis of unawareness of how we exist, how others exist. And then based on that, all the various aspects of compulsiveness of karma and the disturbing emotions perpetuate our samsaric rebirth. So what we want to develop, and what we develop here, is renunciation. That's the determination to be free of all of this, which means the willingness to give up the causes of uncontrollably recurring rebirth, causes of our problems. So it's not just giving up unhappiness. Of course, everybody wants to give up being unhappy, but we have to recognize the true causes for it, which we have just done through this whole process and the intermediate scope, and develop this strong wish. Enough already. I'm bored. I'm sick and tired of it. Got to get out. Then the way to get out of that is to develop, of course, the discriminating awareness of voidness, that we project that we and others, everything exists in impossible ways, and that doesn't correspond to reality. In order to stay focused with that, we need concentration. In order to be able to stick with concentration, we need ethical discipline. So that was the three higher trainings in ethical discipline, concentration, and discriminating awareness. So that was the intermediate scope. Now, the advanced scope is what we are up to, and we saw that the motivation that we want to achieve here, that we want to attain here, is that it's not enough to gain liberation from uncontrollably recurring rebirth ourselves, because everybody else is in that same situation. We are completely interconnected with everybody. And also, we haven't gone far enough with our development. So what we want to do is to develop the two intentions, the intention to reach enlightenment and the intention to benefit all beings. This helps us to overcome the two types of complacency or apathy that we would have in the state of liberation. Being a liberated being, or an arahat, we might feel quite smug and satisfied. Smug is probably too strong a word. Let's say satisfied that we have fulfilled our own purposes, but actually we haven't. If we think of the enlightened state of a Buddha and all the things that we are not able to do in terms of the strength and ability of a Buddha to positively influence others and the omniscient awareness of a Buddha that is able to know everything. So we haven't really fulfilled all the purposes of ourself that we could do. We haven't developed the furthest. So we have to develop great confidence in the state of Buddhahood. And only with that will we be able to overcome the complacency of staying in this nirvana state of liberation. Because of feeling that we have satisfied all our own purposes, because we haven't. And then the compassion, love, concern for others will help us to overcome the complacency of being in this liberated state, because we haven't actually fulfilled the aims of others. So Tsongkhapa emphasizes very much, coming out of Asanga's Bodhisattva Bhumi, the stages of the Bodhisattva level of mind, that we need to develop both of these intentions very strongly, not just love and compassion. That's not enough in terms of Mahayana. We also have to have this great respect and aspiration for enlightenment itself. Very important. Then, bodhicitta is when we are boosted by these mental factors. We're just talking about these intentions and so on, and admiration and firm conviction and the state of enlightenment and love and compassion and so on, then we focus on our not yet happened enlightenment, which can happen on the basis of our Buddha nature potentials, all the various factors that will allow us to become a Buddha. Basically, we're talking about the two networks, the networks of positive force and deep awareness. These two networks are going to be responsible for, they will transform, and they are the obtaining cause. It's known as like the seed for the sprout, that it gives rise to the result, and in giving rise to the result, it itself is finished. Just as at the time of the sprout, the seed no longer is there. So at the time of the various bodies of the Buddha, these networks are no longer there. They have given rise to the Buddha bodies. And here we're talking about this positive force which we have built up by acting constructively. Love, compassion, meditation, all these sort of things that will give rise to the form bodies of a Buddha, the forms with which a Buddha can benefit others, physical bodies, whole network of them. That's why it's called a corpus, or usually it's translated as body, but that's not just meaning one body, it's meaning a whole infinite number of manifestations. There is the Sambhogakaya. Sambhogakaya is, people translate it all sorts of ways. This word Sambhoga used for, has many meanings in both Sanskrit and Longsujoba, the Tibetan translation, similarly has all these different meanings. It can mean, basic meaning is to make use of something, but it can also mean to enjoy something, it can mean to eat something. So making use in that sort of sense. So when people translate it as the enjoyment body, that's really not the intended meaning of the term. It is a body that makes full use, so it's making full use of the Mahayana teachings in order to teach the Arya Bodhisattvas, those who have already had non-conceptual cognition of voidness, teaches them in these Pure Land Buddha fields forever, lasts forever, and teaches them only the Mahayana. So Bhogakaya, then emanations of them, the so-called emanation bodies, Nirmanakaya, are those that are emanations of Sambhogakaya that then are in the usual world with usual beings and in many different forms. Supreme Nirmanakaya, like Buddha with all the various physical signs, Buddha Shakyamuni, or as an artisan, so there are certainly manifestations of Buddhas that teach art and music. And then there are the emanations as personages, such as the great spiritual teachers. Network of positive force is what gives rise to that, but it has to be helped or supported by a network of deep awareness. Deep awareness is basically deep awareness of voidness. We're totally absorbed on it. That's the definitional aspect of this network, and that gives rise to the Dharmakaya, the mind of a Buddha, the omniscient mind of a Buddha. That has to be helped by positive force. We need the two of these, and when we don't have pure motivation in terms of constructive behavior, in terms of meditation on Four Noble Truths, voidness, etc. When we don't have those, when we have so-called neurotic disturbing emotions, then these two networks just build up samsara. Further rebirth, uncontrollably recurring rebirth. So they have to have motivation. If there is renunciation behind them, then they build up liberation. If there is bodhicitta behind them, they build up enlightenment. So we have samsara building networks, liberation building networks and enlightenment building networks. So it's very important to work on the motivation. Motivation is essential here. Otherwise, we just continue further and further in uncontrollably recurring existence. So these Buddha nature factors, these two networks, we can look at them on the basis level. That's what builds up samsara, Buddha nature, but it builds up samsara on the basis level. On the pathway level, it is referring to when we have developed renunciation or bodhicitta with it, so then it's acting as a path for building up toward liberation or enlightenment, and the resultant level as the bodies of Buddha. Okay. Then there's also the voidness of the mental continuum that will account for becoming enlightened. Otherwise, we could never change. We could never be influenced by what we are doing on the path. Is responsible for the so-called essential nature bodies, Svabhavakaya, of a Buddha. With bodhicitta, then, we are aiming toward that not yet happened enlightenment, our own individual enlightenment, which has not yet happened, on the basis of our Buddha nature factors. In other words, that not yet happening enlightenment is imputed on the absence of a presently happening enlightenment on our mental continuum. We're not enlightened yet. So because of that absence, then we can impute that it has not yet happened. However, on the basis of these Buddha nature factors, there's a certain aspect of them upon which, that we can speak of in terms of this is the potential to the, it has the ability, in other words, these tendencies, these networks have the ability, one aspect of, or facet of it, is that it has the ability to give rise to the enlightened state, you know, the various Buddha bodies, when all the causes and when all the conditions are complete. So that's what we mean on the basis of that, the Buddha nature factors. We're aiming at that not yet happened enlightenment. And when we aim at that not yet happening enlightenment, this is conceptual. It has to be conceptual because we're not yet enlightened. Conceptual means to focus on it through a category. We have the category enlightenment. And we represent that category with some sort of mental picture, usually. We have a mental picture that represents enlightenment for us. It can be the image of a Buddha. It could be the image of our spiritual teacher. We can also use the nature of the mind to represent it, the pure nature of the mind. That's much more difficult, what we do in Mahamudra meditation. And conceptual, because this is what represents enlightenment to us. Through that category enlightenment, we can't just focus on enlightenment yet, because only, you know, without being through this category, because we're not enlightened yet. So how do we know what enlightenment is? We can only represent it. Some sort of idea of it, we would say, in Western terminology. So that is what we're focusing on with bodhicitta. Something that represents our not yet happened enlightenment, which can happen because these Buddha nature factors have an aspect that can give rise to them when the conditions are complete. And we are imputing that it's not yet happened on the basis of the fact that we are not yet, that there's an absence of a presently happening enlightenment now. That's very important. Otherwise, you get crazy thinking that I'm already enlightened. So it is not a matter of either free will or determinism in terms of developing bodhicitta. Free will would imply that there is a me totally separate from all of this that can choose to become enlightened or not, as if from a menu. But then if there were a truly existent me separate from all of this, it would be like encapsulated in plastic. It couldn't do anything. And the choices would already be there. You could choose them. And that's also absurd. So it's certainly not free will. You know, on this whole process, we can label the conventional me that I am doing this, of course, but not the false me. The false me that, you know, the truly existent big, big ego me that I am doing this sort of thing. And it's not a case of determinism either. Determinism would imply that the result already exists inside the cause. And we refuted this. Shantideva refutes this very nicely. So does Chandrakirti in their texts on voidness. That it's not that our enlightened state is sitting inside these Buddha nature factors, waiting to pop out when all the conditions are complete. If that were the case, then nothing could affect it. Why would it need to arise again if it's already arisen, and so forth? So there are many logical inconsistencies if we think that the enlightened state is determined as sitting already inside the Buddha nature factors, inside these networks. So it's a matter of tremendous work that we have to do. Last time, we were looking at the four conditions for developing a bodhicitta aim. It was really quite wonderful. That what are the conditions that we've seen or heard about these incredible strength and ability of a Buddha to help others, and wow, I want to aim for that. Or we have read the text and we think, wow, this is so incredible. Must be an omniscient mind behind that. I really want to attain that. Or we think that the Dharma is degenerating, Mahayana practice is degenerating, and is of such benefit to others. I've got to work to achieve enlightenment in order to make sure that the Dharma continues, that it endures. Or it could be that in this terrible time, everybody is in such a bad state that and it's so rare to develop bodhicitta and become enlightened. I've got to do it and show the others. I can perhaps inspire them and help them. So these are the conditions that we discussed last time. Okay. That was a lot. Sometimes I feel inspired to give long introduction. Also, we have somebody new in our class today, so need a little bit longer introduction. So now, Tsongkhapa goes on in his explanation. And he says that in addition to these conditions, we also need the four causes. Four causes for enlightenment. We need all four of them. First, splendid Buddha nature family trait. When we talk about Buddha nature, that's a Western term. There is no such term like that that I'm familiar with. That would literally mean Buddha nature. What it's talking about are the so-called family traits. Family here is the same word as caste, so the caste traits. So what are the traits or characteristics of the caste or family of everybody who could become a Buddha? And in Abhisamaya Alamkara by Maitreya, this is the ornament or filigree of realizations, which discusses a tremendous amount of detail about all the various insights that, and realizations we gain in these five paths or pathway minds. Won't go into detail about that. But anyway, it's an extremely complex text. And in it, and the Tibetans study it for 5 years as part of their Geshe or Kenpo program. In that text, that text is explained in terms of the Svatantrika theories. And according to the Svatantrika tenet system, there are various types of family traits. The Shravaka family, Pratyekabuddha family, Bodhisattva family, etc. Mixed family. And that means that we have this stronger tendency or push to become Shravaka. Shravaka is a listener to the teachings, just working for their own liberation. Pratyekabuddha is those that are self-evolved. They attain liberation during these dark periods, these dark ages when no Buddhas are available, just based on their instincts. And then Bodhisattva family, Bodhisattva family trait. Do you think in terms of beginningless rebirth, and obviously everybody has all of these, but what Tsongkhapa is saying, that we have to have very strong Mahayana characteristic within us, you know, this Buddha nature aspect. So it's the first one, cause. Second is having been, literally the word here is held by a spiritual teacher. Held means we are within the care of a teacher. You know, you always have this expression, it's very lovely, you know, hold me fast or tight with your hook of compassion to the teacher, that the teacher is taking care of us. That care, and taking care doesn't mean, you know, in just a trivial sort of superficial sense, but looking after us, helping us, guiding us, inspiring us, all of these sort of things. This is very, very important, because we need inspiration, guidance to be able to go along the path. We need some sort of example to help show us the way. That's the second. Third cause is compassion and loving affection toward limited beings. So that's quite obvious that we need that in order to develop bodhicitta. And then the fourth, is not being discouraged by the difficult things to take on in dealing with samsara. Very important. Think about that. Not being discouraged by the difficult things to take on and dealing with samsara. To help others, we have to do an unbelievable amount of work. I think just in terms of my website, you know, every little task that I have to do is an enormous amount of work. Correcting Arabic spelling, doing Chinese formatting, doing unbelievable amount for fundraising and stuff like that, and not being discouraged by the difficult things you have to take on, that you have to do in order to deal with samsara and help others. Just do it. It doesn't matter how difficult it is. It doesn't matter how much work is involved. I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to get discouraged. So strong courage, strong strength. That's cause for developing bodhicitta. Tremendous courage is involved. And this is why the Tibetans translate bodhisattva, Chanchub Sempa. Chanchub is a purified state of liberation of a Shravaka, Pratyeka Buddha, or a purified state of a Buddha. It's Chanchub. Chang is, has... purified away the negativities, and Chub has attained the positive qualities. That's Chang Chub. Sem is the mind, so that's all that we have with Chitta. Bodhi was the first, was Chang Chub, and Chitta is actually just Sem, mind. Mind, heart, you know, all of that's the same, and all included in one term. The mind, your heart is set on enlightenment. But then, Sempa can be spelled, the pa can be spelled in two ways. One just makes it into the agent, the one who has a mind aimed at enlightenment. That would be the simpler way of translating the Sanskrit. The Tibetans spell the pa in a different way with the word that means courage. And so Sempa, the one with a courageous mind, to attain enlightenment. It's like what Sirkha Rinpoche always said, that the Tibetan language, the Tibetan way of translating, is something that you can milk the meaning out of. You know, milk the meaning out of each syllable, out of each word, like milking a cow. Lovely image. So, tremendous courage. So this is something we need to think about. Do I have Buddha nature, pure Buddha nature? things? Do I have all the factors that really would allow me to become a Buddha? Is this something which is very strong in me? That I'm aiming for that, you know, not just, you know, for my selfish aims, for my own purposes. And do I have a spiritual teacher, somebody that's guiding me, or at least the intention to find one? It would be the start. Receptivity for that, which means overcoming arrogance. That, you know, I know everything, I don't need anybody to, you know, to tell me what to do or how to practice or stuff like that. Requires great humility, not to become subservient like a slave, but to be receptive to guidance of a teacher. But this, of course, means a fully qualified teacher, not just a, you know, somebody who has a name or somebody goes around claiming that they're teachers. There are many charlatans around who claim to be spiritual teachers, properly qualified one. So as we have this Buddha nature aspect, do we have teacher, do we have a proper attitude toward the teacher, love and compassion, and do we have this courage not to be discouraged by the difficult things? I don't care how difficult it is. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to do it. So think about that. Okay, what would help us to not get discouraged? What would help? Anyone?
The deepest level, a very good understanding of what we are aiming for, what enlightenment is all about.
Right, a good understanding of what enlightenment is all about, but wouldn't you get discouraged thinking that it might take 3 zillion eons? With Tantra, if you're really strong, there is the statement that you could attain it within one lifetime, in fact, within 3 years and 3 phases of the moon. But that hardly, hardly happens. And it is, as His Holiness says, one can use this to encourage people on the one hand, but not to fool people into thinking that it is easy or that, you know, maybe 1 in 100 billion will be able to do that. But it is unbelievably rare and difficult and only possible if you have built up an unbelievable amount of positive force already. Then, within this lifetime, that number 3 years and 3 phases of a moon comes from the Kalachakra teachings, and it has to do with the number of breaths that go into the central channel. According to the Kalachakra teachings, we have 12 shifts of the breath during day and night, in which the breath goes primarily through the right nostril or the left nostril. If you become observant, you'll notice that it, as you know, as you're breathing, stronger in one nostril than the other. So it shifts back and forth during the course of the day and night. And when it makes that shift, there's a certain small number, I forget the exact number, something like 675 and a quarter or something like that. Don't quote me on that number, something like that. Pass into the central channel as the breath shifts. And these are called deep awareness breaths. And in order to access the clear light mind, subtlest level of mind, which is the most efficient for gaining the non-conceptual cognition of voidness, you have to get all the breaths and winds and energies of the body, into the subtle body, into the central channel. So, if we have 670-something, each of the 12 shifts of a day and night of these breaths, then to get all the breaths in, you know, into, then the, to say that again, the amount of breaths that you would have in the central channel in a 100-year lifespan, if you took all those breaths and made them consecutive, you know, that you had that all the time, day and night, the amount of time that that would be 3 years and three phases of the moon. And it is from that calculation, from Kala Chakra, that you get the custom of doing three-year retreats. Three-year, three phases of the moon, to be more precise. Phase of the moon is a fortnight, 2 weeks, 15 days. So, this is where we get the number from. Doesn't mean that very many people actually attain it. It is what we would call an auspicious number in Buddhist terminology. What else would we need? What I think there's something more primary than that to help us not to get discouraged.
Not being attached to difficulties.
Not being attached to difficulties.
So the focus on our everyday existence, if we're focused always on the disturbing emotions and focused on difficulties, then we will, that keeps us from...
Right, so if we focus on the difficulties, we focus on our disturbing emotions, and may I add to that, and complain about it, then of course we get discouraged. But what will, so you're saying to not get discouraged, you have to stop focusing on that. But there's something even stronger.
Just been thinking of role models, people who...
Thinking of role models, inspiration. Right, but inspiration, the force of inspiration and the force of our compulsiveness was usually translated as the force of karma and the force of the blessings of the Buddha. But that those two don't mean anything. So, to most people. So, our compulsive energy and the energy of the inspiration of a Buddha, those are equal. One isn't stronger than the other. If the compulsive energy of karma was stronger, then nobody could get enlightened. If the inspiration of a Buddha could outweigh the compulsive energy that we have, then everybody should be enlightened already. So inspiration from teachers, role models, Buddhas, etc. can help us, but compulsively getting discouraged, not so easy. What else?
To see, to me, that there's nothing other worthwhile to do. There's nothing, everything else is boring.
Right, so there's nothing else to do. So basically renunciation.
Yeah.
Everything else is boring as samsaric, so there's nothing else to do, so don't get discouraged with samsara. We want to get out of it. So the force of renunciation would help us not to get discouraged. Because as the famous saying goes, what do you expect from samsara? Of course it's going to be difficult.
Even if it's going, if it's not going not good, or if it's going badly, so then there's nothing, What can one do?
What can one do? So equanimity. Equanimity to the eight worldly feelings, the so-called transitory things in life. In life, the eight worldly dharmas. Things going well, not going well, so what? Life goes up and down. So basic equanimity toward these things. Hear good news, hear bad news, win some, lose some.
Same, same.
What else? To me, it's so obvious. Nobody's coming up with it. Yes?
Love.
There we go. Love and compassion. Exactly. I've got to deal with all these difficulties because other people need me. They're suffering so terribly. How can I get discouraged and say, you know, sorry, too difficult to help you? That helps us not to get discouraged. I think that's the strongest force, especially if we're thinking in terms of Mahayana, which is where this whole discussion is there. For developing bodhicitta, don't get discouraged because we think of the suffering of others and we can't bear it. Especially if we think in terms of our mothers. And mind you, in an Indian and Tibetan context, it seems as though people don't have difficulties with their mother. In any case, bare minimum. She didn't abort us. She gave birth to us. Bare minimum. He was very kind. No matter how terrible our mother must have been, at least she didn't have an abortion of us. So, kindness of the mothers. Love, compassion. That helps us not to get discouraged. And all the other things that you said, but I think the strongest is the love and compassion. Okay. And this equanimity to the eight transitory things in life, the eight worldly feelings, that's very important. Samsara goes up and down, so what do I expect? Of course it's going to be difficult sometimes. But we're not talking so much. This is not talking, though, about when things go badly. You know, the eight transitory things are talking about when things go smoothly and then things are difficult. I mean, things going badly. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the difficult things to take on. There's a Tibetan word here. Kaju. Things that are difficult to deal with. What's difficult to deal with? People being hungry, people starving. That's on a regular level. People getting, just dealing with people. I mean, so many of the teachings on the far-reaching attitudes, you know, patience, the patience of dealing with people because they're really difficult to help. Shantideva talks about that a lot. You try to help them and they argue back at you. They don't want your help. Requires tremendous patience. You give them really good advice and they don't take it. They do the opposite anyway. Not to get discouraged with that. They never learn. You know, they constantly want to become dependent on you. And push them out of the nest, you know, come on. Make decisions on your own. No, you know. You're the guru, you're the teacher, you're the parent. Decide for me. Some people are like that, not everybody, obviously. Is it difficult? And they want to rebel against you. How many people have children who are rebellious? How do you help them? Don't get discouraged. That's what it's talking about. Not to get discouraged by the really difficult things in dealing with samsara, not just your own samsara horrors, samsara of everybody else. So how well prepared are we to do that? Think about it. You're a teacher in school. How difficult it is, you know, and the students don't want to learn, and there's discipline problems and stuff like that. Or, you know, two of our people here are social workers dealing with difficult teenagers. They're really difficult to deal with, aren't they? And it's easy to get discouraged, isn't it? They're shaking their heads, yes. So, if one wants to develop bodhicitta, it's going to be even harder to bring these kids to enlightenment than it is to just help them deal with life. Samsara life. So, how do you not get discouraged? It's by really taking the sufferings of others seriously. They have feelings, and they want to be free of their suffering just as much as I do. And they're really confused about how to do that. So, as Shantideva says, although they want to avoid suffering, they just, you know, head into making more suffering for themselves. And rather than get discouraged at that, and develop even more compassion. That's a cause for developing bodhicitta. So think about it. And if it's easier, relate it to your own children, if you have children. Okay, then, last thing that Tsongkhapa discusses in this section is really wonderful. He talks about how you develop bodhicitta through the four forces. So we have the four conditions, and we have the four causes, and now four forces. And this can be a combination of any of them, any amount of them. The first is through one's own force. You're going to develop bodhicitta and work toward enlightenment through your own force. It's the force, it's the wish to attain complete enlightenment through one's own strength. Willpower. What I'm going to rely on. I'm going to do it. Through my own strength. I don't care if there's nobody else that's doing it. I don't care if, you know, everybody in my spiritual community is completely neurotic and messed up. I don't care that, you know, some of the teachers are abusing students and so on. I don't care. Through my own strength, my own conviction, rely on the Dharma, Buddha Dharma, Arya Sangha, and do it. That's the force. So, okay, do I have that? Second is the force of others. wish to attain the full enlightenment of a Buddha through the strength of others. I need this, the support of a spiritual community. I need the support of my teachers, you know, helping me a lot all along the path. I need this support system. And through the strength of the support system, you know, of the monastic community and all of these sort of things, going to attain enlightenment. This becomes a very interesting, dynamic here. How much are we relying on our own force? How much do you need to rely on the force of others to give us strength? It's talking about strength, is the term that Tsongkhapa is using in Tibetan. Where do you get your strength from? Do you look to yourself to get the strength? Or are you looking to others to help give you the strength or to supplement your strength? What do you say?
For me, it's like going through phases, you know. Sometimes It's I'm really self-inspired, you know, to work on that. But sometimes, you know, I'm getting a bit lazy, and then I need to rely on others, you know.
So he says that he goes through phases. Sometimes he's self-inspired. At other times, he gets lazy and. To help us to overcome laziness, this is a very important reason why we rely on the strength of others. They help to give us the discipline and the perseverance and so on to overcome our laziness if we're in a group and everybody else is doing it. I know this from my fitness club. I am in classes at the fitness club. They're 45 minutes long. If I were doing exercise by myself on the machines, no way that I would stick with it for 45 minutes. You're in a class with 20, 30 people. You can't just walk out in the middle. So the force of others. And do my 45 minutes of exercise. So if that's the case just for doing physical exercise, a lot of people can't do retreat by themselves. They need a group retreat. Give them the discipline to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and sit for hour after hour. Anyone else? Which one is more stable? Tsongkhapa quotes a sangha from Bodhisattva Bhumi about this. Stages of the Bodhisattva mind. Which one is more stable? The first one, right, relying on your own strength. The Sangha says that, and Tsongkhapa repeats it. Why is relying on your own strength more stable, more reliable, more firm than relying on the force of others?
Other circumstances can change quite quick, and also one could project something on the outer things that would go in accordance with what one would not like to do. For example, one is not too much inspired anymore, and they are all around, they are also quite lazy. I see here that they are not so nice doing practice, and if one is
right, so if we are relying on the strength of others, then rather than criticizing ourselves in terms of how we're doing, we criticize the others. we see the faults. And there's this lovely saying that we mirror our faults onto others. Classic example is there's one piece of cake left. We're in a group at the table, and somebody else takes that piece of cake, and then we accuse them of being greedy. Why did we accuse them of being greedy? Because we wanted that piece of cake. If we didn't want that piece of cake, what does it matter? Who took it? Not at all. But you're greedy, because I wanted it myself. So we tend to project our own disturbing emotions to others. It's very, very common, especially in arguments with partners. It happens all the time. So that's a reason why, if we are relying on our own strength, we have nobody to blame except ourselves if we're not
practicing. That's true.
Also, I'm reminded of Shantideva again. Samsaric beings let you down. You can't rely on them. You can't rely on a spiritual community at your Dharma center. They will inevitably let you down. They are samsaric beings. What do you expect? The only thing that won't let you down are the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Sangha being Arya Sangha, not this Western usage of Sangha for the congregation of your Buddhist center. It's a Western adaptation of this word. Doesn't mean that at all. Arya Sangha, those who have non-conceptual cognitional voidness already.
They probably won't bring you down.
They won't bring you down. They won't bring you down. But, again, even relying on the force of others in terms of relying on the Buddhas to save me, as it were, that also is not as firm as your willpower to do it. Because if you just sit passively and, oh Buddha, save me, not much is going to happen. You have to have your own strength. Yeah?
But since you yourself are a samsara being as well, how can your own strength be any stronger than the other people's strength?
Right, that's very, very good. We ourselves are a samsara being, so how can our strength be any stronger than, any more stable than anybody else's strength? Because of compassion. Because of love. I mean, it's under our control. What we do with motivation. I can correct my own motivation. I can't correct somebody else's motivation. I can revigorate my own strength. It's very hard to revigorate others. Some people might be receptive. You could inspire them. That was one of the conditions for developing bodhicitta. I'm going to do it so that I can inspire others. Set an example. But that's not so easy. And they may be receptive, they may not be receptive. But it is within our own hands to affect our own state of mind. So yes, I'm a samsaric being, but then we have the teachings on perseverance. And one of the factors to develop that support perseverance is to know when to take a break. To know when to ease off. If you push too hard, it's self-defeating. Can't push too hard. But on the other hand, you can't treat yourself like a baby either. So you have to learn, you know, the right amount of the way to push yourself. Not too much, not too little. The old Circle Rinpoche, my teacher, was wonderful with that. I used to translate with him or study with him, and he always said that you can do 5 minutes more than you think you can do. When you feel that you can't go on, you can do 5 minutes more. And he would push me to do 5 minutes more. That way, you grow. Very, very helpful. Very helpful. Like a good trainer. Yeah, I go to a fitness club, so I have these analogies with that. So I just started with a personal trainer, in addition to the classes that I go to. And with a personal trainer, I mean, it can be in a class as well. You know, you're exhausted, you know, you've done so many of a particular exercise, and he says, come on, you can do two more, or one more. And usually you can do one or two more, you know, when you've reached the point where if you were on your own, you wouldn't do anymore. You push one more. So that's the strength of somebody else, isn't it? Encouraging it. So usually I think we need a combination, relying on self and others, but the Sangha and Tsongkhapa confirm, you know, agrees that the strength of oneself, one's own strength, is more stable. If you have that, if you have it, this is the point, if you have it, it's more stable. Third force, the force of a cause. Having previously become habituated with Mahayana in previous lives, then just at hearing the praise of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, just hearing about Buddhism, you're automatically, instinctively drawn toward it, toward Mahayana. This is opposed to the fourth force, which is the force of application. Which is, you know, you work really, really hard in this lifetime. Literally, you've habituated yourself to constructive factors for a long time in this lifetime, such as entrusting yourself to a spiritual master, thinking about the Dharma you've heard, and so on. So here we have two forces. One is the force of instincts from previous lives that sort of automatically draw you toward Buddhism, toward Mahayana, especially toward altruism. You might even not know that it's Buddhism, but just toward altruism, toward helping others, and the force of really working hard in this lifetime to build it up. Which is the stronger one? Again, the Sangha and Tsongkhapa talk about that. Which is the stronger one? More stable, he says, is the term they're using. Which is the more stable? You don't know. What is in your life? Do you feel instinctively drawn from childhood toward this path?
From childhood, I've never heard about this path in childhood.
Pardon?
I've never heard about such a path.
You never heard about such a path? Well, yeah.
But I felt drawn to the path when I heard about it.
When you heard about it, the first... Well, that's what I said. When you hear about it, then instinctively...
Yeah.
You say, you know, boing, you know, this is what I want to do. This makes sense to me.
Sounds quite stable, actually.
Pardon? That's much more stable.
Sounds quite stable, you know?
That's much more stable. Then if you hear about it, well, your friends are going, you know, oh, come on, let's come along. And then you work hard, and it develops. Obviously, we need a combination of the two. But there are some people I've met, you know, and going around the world teaching, that I'm teaching in a center, and there's this 14-year-old, this happened twice, 14 years old,
brought there by their parents. These 14-year-olds ask the most intelligent questions, the most, you know, interested. They outshine everybody there. And I've kept in contact with them, so they continue. There's strong instincts from past lives. So, a Sangha, Bodhisattva Bhumi, Tsongkhapa quotes it. Actually, he doesn't quote it, he refers to it. Says that the most stable, most firm, relying on your own force and previous lifetimes. If you're relying on the force of others and the hard work you do in this lifetime, it's less firm. So, think about it. What do we have?
Some instincts, but I don't work hard.
Right, so some people have instincts, but they don't work hard. Some people also, you know, they live in places in which, you know, I'm thinking of people living, you know, in various places, in Russia, for example, but they really don't, you know, the community is not supportive, isn't anyone around supporting of it, you know. People their age into a lot of alcohol and so on. And they're looking for some support from others. That situation, it's very hard to just generate your own strength. So sometimes we need the strength of others to get us started. Even if you have strong instincts, then your own strength can take over. So it's a combination of these things. Combination. Anyway, Tsongkhapa finishes this statement, and this section, I should say. He says, so when we understand well that the teaching, you know, he's putting everything together, when we understand well that the teachings in general, and especially Mahayana, are close to disappearing, and that the degenerate times we live in are especially degenerate, and we realize from the depth of our heart that the development of bodhicitta is extremely rare, then rely on a holy teacher, a spiritual master, and apply yourself with effort to listening to the texts, thinking about them, etc., and put down the roots for developing sincere bodhicitta through your own force without being under the power or influenced or forced by others, and without mindlessly running after or following others or doing it just out of custom. Very strong. Of course, a monstrous sentence, which is the style that Tsongkhapa writes in. So, now the various conditions, you know, you realize that the teachings are really close to disappearing. You think about what's going on in China and Cambodia and stuff like that. Close to disappearing. And the degenerate times are especially degenerate. People's disturbing emotions are really strong. Mind you, you have the Green Movement and, you know, the Occupy Wall Street Movement and all these other things that are going on. But, you know, the majority of people are very disturbed. Global warming and all this sort of stuff. and realize from your depth of your heart that developing bodhicitta is extremely rare. How many people do that? Hardly anybody. So then, those conditions, rely on a teacher, find a teacher, entrust a qualified teacher, and entrust yourself to the teacher, and apply yourself with effort to listening to the teachings, that means studying, learning them, thinking about them, trying to put it all together sincerely, and put down the roots, in other words, plant all the causes and conditions for developing sincere bodhicitta through your own force, so that it'll come from your own strength. Do it with your own strength, without being under the power influenced by others. Here he uses, for the force of others, Tsongkhapa is using, a much more strong thing here. You don't want to be forced by others. By group pressure and these sort of things, or under the power of others, charismatic teacher that might lead you astray. So don't just be under the influence of somebody else. Have your own strength, and without mindlessly running after or following others. Everybody in your group, all your peers are doing it, so mindlessly you go as well. They all go to a rock concert, you go to a rock concert. They all go to a bar or a pub afterwards, you go to the bar or pub afterwards. Don't just mindlessly run after the herd. And don't do it just out of custom if we are born into a Buddhist family, in a Buddhist country or society. Don't just do it because that's the custom. But develop your own strength. That's true for any religion, isn't it? So, that's how Tsongkhapa ends this section.
This is from Lamrim
Chemo. I took it straight out. Mm-hmm. Translating myself, Lamrim Chemo. Grand presentation of the paths. How old is this? This was written in the beginning of the 1400s. Maybe it was in the late 1300s. I don't really know what the date was. So that's about 600 years old.
Is there often a sense of degradation throughout Buddhism?
Is there a sense of degradation throughout Buddhism? Yes, absolutely. So the teachings are slowly degenerating, disappearing from the time when Buddha taught, and then they will completely disappear after 2,500 years. 5,000 years. It's a different number from Kalachakra. Kalachakra, I forget what it was, 5,200 or something like that. And the other teachings, it's 5,000 years, so we're halfway through. So it degenerates in the sense that in the beginning a lot of people attain liberation, later it becomes more rare. Eventually people just wear the robes, but they don't really keep the vows. Or they just recite the text, but they don't know what it means. This sort of degeneration until finally it disappears. Pardon?
Is it unavoidable?
That's fairly unavoidable. That's the general trend. That doesn't mean that you as an individual can't do it in terms of gaining liberation, enlightenment. But the support is going to be less. So that's why, another reason why you have to rely on your own force, who's the more stable. Because everybody around you might just be doing pujas, just reciting without having the foggiest idea of what they're doing, just doing rituals. Blind rituals. I'm not saying that rituals are useless. Rituals are not useless. But mindless rituals in which you're just sort of, Buddhist entertainment, Disneyland. Buddhist Disneyland, you're ringing your bell and your drum and you're playing and chanting in a language you don't even know what you're saying. What is that? Where is that going to get you? So even if, that's a sign of degeneration. So if everybody is just attracted to that,
then it's even more difficult for you to say, you know, I'm really going to try to learn the teachings, understand the teachings, practice the teachings, not just play with them. Yeah.
What I've heard from what His Holiness said when...
His Holiness said, I'm quoting His Holiness the Dalai Lama on this. He is very strong about that. What I was just saying, you know, study. Don't just do, you know, recite, you know, blah, 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 blah.
When a disciple complained, or some student asked or complained about, we are in so degenerated times, it's so difficult to achieve attainment and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh yeah, times are difficult and degenerating, but if you now practice as Milarepa, you will achieve attainment like Milarepa. So,
right.
It's, the times are, as you said, yeah, the conditions are getting worse, but if you still put the same effort and power in it...
We had this, you know, not being discouraged by the difficult things to take on when dealing with samsara. It's getting more and more difficult. And it will be even more difficult in the future. You look at global warming and all these sort of things, it's going to be much more difficult in the future in terms of just physical life. Don't get discouraged. And then what happens is that eventually the teachings will disappear, it says. And then there's a long dark age before another Buddha comes. So this is cyclical. Here we are. Buddhists teach in other universes, so we have to be born in other universes to continue. But Buddhism asserts that life, many, many places around the universe, not just on this planet. Anyway, let us end with a dedication. I think whatever understanding, whatever positive forces come from this, may it go deeper and deeper, and really act as a cause for reaching enlightenment. As I see how incredible enlightenment is, this is fantastic, I really need to attain this, and how much need there is for this of love and compassion. So please, I really want this force and understanding to help to contribute toward building up enlightenment for the benefit of all. The enlightenment of everybody, not just my own.